coming to you from Orange County, California. This is the Jug Life Podcast with Max Ada and Chad Wesley Smith.
Hey everybody, what is up? Chad Wesley Smith here. Another episode of the Jug Life Podcast, continuing my travels through the fine state of Georgia. And today I am joined by 2012 bronze medalist in the shot put, five-time U.S. national champion, the man formerly known as the masked thrower.
Yes.
Reese Hoffa. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing good. Thank you for having me.
That was a very fun memory in my throwing career, because you know, coming up for me was my kind of end of high school, beginning of college. You, Adam, Christian, at the peaks. And you and Adam were really my guys because you were short.
Yes.
And I was like, oh, I can't be like Christian Cantwell and 6 foot six.
It's true.
Yeah. And I was like, who's this guy wearing the mask?
Well, the things that you will do to get into a professional track meet, that was the only reason I really did it, is I wanted to get into a professional track meet that actually paid me a robust $500 to wear a mask and compete against these guys.
A little Lucha Libre action.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Between that and the turkey legs, it looked like you were always having fun out there.
That was always my goal. And because my idols are Brian Ofield, Dave Lout, I mean, all these guys that have a lot of personality. Brett Noon, who got me to Georgia. These people are just so much fun, and they have a lot of fun doing it. And I wanted to bring that experience to every kid that watched me throw.
So, going back, talking about Brent Noon bringing you to Georgia, and we were talking about before we started that Georgia is a football state, and you grew up here in Augusta, Georgia, not too far away from where we are here in Athens or Watkinsville. What got you into throwing the shot put, and how did you arrive at the University of Georgia?
So the first time I ever threw a shot was in fourth grade during an Olympics back then. Our PE teacher brought a shot put out. I tried it. It was interesting, but I didn't think anything of it. I started throwing in eighth grade while I was playing baseball. David Mikovic was the throws coach at the high school at the time. Went up there. We're like, hey, I want to do shot put. He told me, you're not going to be good at shot put, so I'm not going to spend that much time with you. So me and
what was the rationale behind you you're not going to be good at shot put?
He didn't want to mess with a bunch of middle school kids.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of a joke. That's why you tell the story. It's just, it's so funny. He's like, if I only would have just grabbed you and said, you know what, if you wanted to be a shot putter, let's be a shot putter. And just knowing what he knows now, it just would have been amazing.
Because
I would have never, like, I played baseball for two more years before committing 100% to track and field in high school.
Because I would have to call into question his talent evaluation abilities if he said you're not going to be good at the shot put and then you win a bronze medal.
Well, I was not, when you're in middle school, you haven't really matured.
For sure.
So, you know, I grew a little bit more. I was a little bit bigger, stronger, a little bit more athletic. I was probably just some goofy middle schooler. I trained a couple of middle schoolers. There's no way, looking at it, like, that kid's going to be great.
Yeah.
I probably was pretty annoying. So I understand where he's coming from. I was just some middle school kid's like, I want to learn how to throw. And I didn't even win. I was horrible at shot put in eighth grade. I got beat all the time. I think the best I ever finished was like fourth at some random meet. You know, so I wasn't good. I didn't show any promise in the sport.
I remember, you know, starting track. I think I was 9 years old when I started throwing the shot put. And seeing some of those kids, especially as we got to be 12, 13 years old, they had gone through puberty or begun that. I had not even close, and guys who were beating me by 10 feet in 7th grade, and then by senior year in high school, I was beating them by 10 feet when they were the exact same size that they were in 7th grade, but that was always kind of a fun feeling.
It is it's a lot of fun. Like, my first year throwing, I experienced a lot of success, but then you go to that national level, and then you go against, like, really good throwers. So I was in that small pond. I'm like, yeah, I'm the best. I won the state championship. And then I go to, like, the National Scholastic, and I finish, like, 12th or something.
Who is the man at your time in high school?
It was, what's his name? I don't want to get his name. I know his last name is DiGiorgio. There's a kid named Dimbo.
Kevin DiGiorgio.
Kevin DiGiorgio.
There's Kevin and Glenn, yeah.
Yeah, Van Mounts was there. He's from California. Those were the kind of the guys. I got fifth that year. That was my senior year. I got fifth against those guys. Kevin Sprague was in that group, too.
I remember Chris Sprague.
Chris Sprague.
I remember him because in the USATF, the youth stuff,
yeah,
looking at, and he'd have every age group record.
Oh, yeah.
Bantams.
The kid was strong.
Yeah. He had to be one of those just 13-year-old man-child.
He was a man-child.
Yeah.
So then you, like, but then I go into college. These are guys who are killing me. We all go to college around, I think we're near the same class, and I'm destroying all of them. Like, Dimbo went to Princeton, and, you know, he's like, we get to Nationals. I end up getting third. I don't even sure he makes the final. So it's just, it's interesting. And it was just because that was like my second year ever picking up a 12-pound ball and throwing. Mm-hmm. I was so inexperienced. I didn't know what I was doing. It took me a year just to learn how to spin. So it's interesting to say, well, these people are killing me now, and then all of a sudden I'm beating them. And the same thing in college. You know, I finished third, was the best ever finished. And all these people that were beating me, Jonas Roberts, Joachim Olsen, with Brad Snyder, all these guys that were just destroying me. Then all of a sudden I turned, you know, 2 years, I'm beating them. It's just the way of the world, I guess.
Yeah. And, you know, with I think for as many stories as there are of, you know, a Ryan Whiting, Ryan Krauser types who are number one at the youth and at the high school and college and beyond, there's maybe just as many, you know,
people you've never heard of.
Yeah, Adam Nelson, 63, 64-foot guy in college. And, you know, just to be able to get those years after college is maybe the toughest part for some people.
Oh, yeah.
That's kind of where I found myself coming out of college. I'd had 2 years off of throwing the shot put in the middle of college. So throw a 64 senior year, and it's like, all right, that's pretty good, but there's these guys throwing 70. So 64 is not, no one's giving any money to throw 64 feet.
No.
So it's sort of that time bridging the gap between, you know, how can I survive for the next 2 or 3 years, whatever it's going to take, to see if those extra feet are there. So you've lived the glamorous life of professional shot putting.
Yeah.
So as you were looking to take, you know, that step from collegiate athlete at Georgia to professional shot putter, where you, you know, live in 10 guys in like a 3-bedroom house, anything like that?
It wasn't 10 guys. So I lived in a house that, let's see, how would you describe it? It had one bathroom. It had 5 bedrooms. So it was 5 of us. It was $150 a month. And it was worth every penny of it. Basically, it was the wood from the outside and then your room. Like, it was built in the 1800s. It had plumbing.
I think on a real estate listing, they would call that cozy.
Or very cozy.
Maybe quaint. A quaint antique home.
It was very, very quaint antique home. I had put my own ceiling fan in and bought a window unit so I could have air conditioning in the room. That's the kind of place it was. It didn't have central air because there's nowhere you could do it. We ran our own cable lines through the house. So the cable company came, put a unit right behind in the living room, and then we just splintered it off into the different rooms. It was incredible. Like, my entire living for like 1 year was probably like $6,000. It's all I had to make to be able to survive. I lived off of the George Foreman grill and the well water. That's all I could afford.
So then how many years after college was it that you had your kind of your breakthrough season?
I think it was maybe my second. So I was done in 2001. 2002, I was just a poor journeyman shot putter. 2003, I make it to the World Championships in Paris and do nothing. But I made a grand total, I think it was like $7,000.
And those would have been from the U.S. Nationals were at Stanford.
They were at Stanford, yeah.
I threw it at the Junior Nationals.
You did? Oh, wow. So that year, I mean, to let you know, it's just, you have to be legends. John Gadina added the height of his powers. Kevin Toth, height of his powers. Adam Nelson, height of his powers. You got to beat pretty much the legends. People that have more medals or more powerful, stronger than you ever will be. These are the people I have to beat. You know, I got them on a bad meet. I just threw what I normally I think I threw to make the team 2003, just around 67 feet or something.
Okay, long ones down the left.
That's my home. To be honest, I didn't even think I'd even make that team. I'm glad I did for the experience, because then I go to the World Championships and do absolutely nothing. I think I fouled out. So I had one. I think I had one legal throw. It would have been like 16-30, and I fouled it. And then the rimming that I got from Don is like, Reese, you never foul a throw at a major championship. I don't care if it's 2 meters. You hold it in. You know, it's like, I didn't know it was a horrible throw.
I would have fouled at 16-30 as well. So
like I was just this fish is out of water. I remember by accident slapping Lars Riedel. Getting on the bus, and my hand missed, and I try to, you know, bring the other hand across. And Lars, you know, he's 6'11", like, bigger than life, just won the Olympic Games. And I slap him across the face, and at that moment, I knew my short career was going to be over. He took it well. He laughed a little bit, but I was just like...
This is like a stumbling...
It was a stumbling slap. So, you know, and you're gonna bring the hand across to try to catch the bar, and I missed. And you broke I don't know why he was so close to the bar.
Yeah, you broke your fall with Lars Riedel's face.
I did, and I was just like... And I don't know him. And he kind of giggled a little bit. Thank God. Because that could have been an international incident, and it would have been over. But, you know, I'm seeing, like, Lars... Of all these people that you see on TV, and I'm watching this guy win the Olympics in 96, I'm just like... Oh my gosh!
Yeah, when you're
there's Sean just Leslie. How are you doing, sir? You're I watched him warm up, and I was just like, that just I wasn't ready for it.
when you're reading about him on the ring and downloading the videos off a Mac throw.
Oh my gosh! To see them. I remember the first time I got on Mac throw, and it was for a foul throw in 2003, and this is right before they made the change. So I threw 70 feet, but it was out of sector, and I was being an honorable person, saying, hey, that was out of sector. The old sector had been in, because, you know, I hung down the left hand on my side, and they put the throw on Mac throw, and that was the moment I knew I've arrived.
Yes.
Because it was a big deal. They didn't put just, they were very selective in terms of what videos they put on there.
Our main audience, I think, powerlifters, weightlifters, so if you're getting the ring and the Mac throw video references... Kudos to you, because
yes.
You're a true OG of throwing on the internet. At least, I was probably sophomore, junior year in high school, getting all those, downloading on the 56K modem,
yes.
Kind of stuff. That was a good time. But for our meathead listeners, they want to know about, you know, lifting and jumping and all that. So what were some of your best results in powerlifts, weightlifting?
So in college, I snatched 297, clean, I think around 375. I ended up getting finally over 500 pounds, like 6 years out of being a pro. I could squat around
550. In the bench press, right?
In the bench press. Yeah. I think in like the 550 range for squat. I mean, eventually I would squat more than I think I did 607. I don't think the lifting was the priority. I just wanted to make sure it was... respectable.
Mm-hmm.
In 500 was I considered like a respectable lift, but I'm not Adam benched 500 pounds as a freshman in college.
Yeah,
like he's a freak of nature. Like I try to lift with Adam and then I die, I wither away. I'm just like, I'm not that kind of guy. How do you get that strong? So I think most of my lifts were just respectable, almost human-esque. No, I know a 500 pound bench is that's great, but in my world, 500 pounds is like, well, that's a warm... Like, I remember seeing Christian Cantwell, who's a 6'6", 350-pound Goliath. He made 500 pounds look like it was 225.
Yeah, it was going to, like, leave his hands at the top.
I know, it's unbelievable watching people that are that powerful when you're just like, how am I supposed to beat this guy? And you just put that out of your mind.
So I remember my senior year of college... I discovered this chart that your coach, Don Babbitt, who I'm going to talk with later today, hopefully, had published, and it was of your progression from your freshman year at UGA through the year that you threw your PR, 22-43, 73-7, and it had your stand throws and overhead back and 30 and standing broad jump and all your lifts. And I'm going through this chart and looking at it and thinking, I can stand throw farther. Overhead back farther, jump farther, lift more, squat more, jump higher, run faster. And then the one cell on this chart that mattered, how far full throw 16-pound shot put. You were killing me by like 3 meters on that. And I was like, something's wrong here. So to that effect, you know, you're talking about you just need to be strong enough. So
yeah,
you're throwing far in a way besides benching 600 and squatting 700 and having a 38-inch vertical. And
yeah,
what do you think was, you know, the secret, the magic to Reese Hoffa's shot putting success?
I think a part of it's got to be Don. I think Don realized when we came in, I can't train someone to do lifting, running, all this kind of stuff on a chart of what everyone else said that you're supposed to do. I'm not 6'5". I'm 5'11", 3/4", just 6 feet. You know,
every quarter inch matters.
But I am not a traditional thrower. I have a very good speed. I can make the ball move really fast. So I'm not going to be as athletic as Brian Ofield. He's taller. He's always going to be better. So we have to figure out what is the Reese's magic. I'm never going to be able to have that big bench. I'm never going to be able to jump that high. So I can't train like those kind of people. I have to train outside the box. And that was the secret sauce. He's like, I know traditionally you look at this, it's like, hey, if you throw a heavier implement, it's going to make the 16 feel lighter. So we tried that, and it killed me. I just can't handle throwing a 17, an 18, a 20-pound ball, doing a full throw. My bones hurt. It's like hurting my elbow. My wrist was killing me. It's just like, Don, I don't think this is working. So he's like, well, let's go the other direction. So we threw nothing but light balls, and I flourished. Traditionally, they're like, you know, in order for you to be great at doing something, you have to take millions of throws. And I would try to do that. And after, you know, doing, not millions of throws, but you throw every day. So instead of, and I'd try that, and by Wednesday, I'm toast. I don't have anything for Thursday, Friday. My practices are horrible, missing positions. And you know, I'm like, Don, I can't, once again, Don, I can't train like that. When I first came to Georgia, that's what we did. We, 3 times a week, we would throw. I bet we built a foundation. But then as I was trying to become a professional, trying to refine my skills, I just couldn't spend that kind of time. I just wasn't recovering. You got to stay on top of your lifts and everything. So we just started trimming the fat. Maybe you can do it 2 days a week. So I had tons of recovery. And this is the one, like, if you ever interview Christian about that, it is the one thing that drives him crazy. He's like, how can a person be a elite level as consistent as you are throwing 2 days a week and you only take 25 throws? And it's sometimes, like, I was ranked number one in the world in 2014. I took 13 throws of practice because I hurt my knee.
And you're like, what? Losing your hair sucks. And I didn't realize how much I cared about mine until I and other people noticed that I was losing it. So for the past 2 months, I've been using Keeps. It's the easiest and most affordable way to keep the hair you have. So since I started using Keeps, I've made sure that my powerful power alleys have not turned into a cul-de-sac. These FDA-approved products used to cost so much, but now, thanks to Keeps, they're finally inexpensive and easy to get. For 5 minutes now and just $1 a day, you never have to worry about hair loss again. Getting started with Keeps is so easy. Sign up takes less than 5 minutes. Just answer a few questions, snap some photos of your hair, and a licensed physician will review your information online and recommend the right treatment for you. Then it's shipped right to your door every 3 months. Keeps offers generic versions of the only two FDA-approved hair loss products out there. Some of you have probably tried them before, but you've probably never gotten them for this price. Keeps is about $10 to $35 a month, plus now you can get your first month free. Hell of a deal for keeping your hair. To receive your first month of treatment for free, go to keeps.com/juglife. That's KEEPS.com/juglife. It's a free month of treatment at keeps.com/juglife. Keeps, hair today, hair tomorrow.
And you're like, well, how in the world? And you only did 2 times a week, 2013 throws. But when I go in, I'm hyper-focused. Every single throw is important, like it's the world championship. And I think Don hopefully will see that. He saw that too. He's just like, when I come to practice, every stand throw, every full throw, every drill that I did, everything was to the highest extent. You know, it was like, I make a mistake here and it has to be instantly corrected, and then I'll move on. And that's just the way we've done it. I feel like sometimes, and I'm kind of faulting the people that do every day, it's just mindless throwing. There's no real focus to what they're doing. They just, I'm going to take 25 throws today, and they take 25 throws. But is it like 25 perfect throws?
Mm-hmm. Mindful, purposeful.
Mindful, perfect throws for a purpose. And that's how we approached every single practice is we come in, we want to throw, and, you know, I throw 15 and a half, and the goal was you have three throws, you're going to throw over 20 meters. And from three throws till your 20th throw, you're going to throw 68 to 69 feet. You're going to work your way from the next, from throw four to throw eight. That's how you're going to get to 21. And then you're just going to throw 21 meters the rest of practice.
So is that a little bit like a range throwing?
It's kind concept? Of like, it's kind of like range throwing. We like to look at it as golf. We're coming in, we're working on the pitching wedge. That's our, you know, stand throw. Okay, we're going to come, let's hit an eight, and that'll be our 20 meter throw. All right, let's start working in some of the driving irons here, pulling out a three iron, and then we're going to pull out the driver for the rest of practice. That's just the way we kind of looked at it, and it worked maybe through the evil genius of Don. And then there's just the other part is just kind of like the mental reps. I did a lot of drilling, and it wasn't that I was, you know, Don's watching the drilling. We would come up with a concept of what we're doing every single practice, and I would attempt to perfect it before I stepped in the ring. That's where I've been the mindful, because I knew there's only going to be so many throws I can take. I'm just not that kind of person. So I come in and I've already drew like little light bulbs I do in my basement or wherever. I think it was like a five or a six, and I would just drill over and over again, just working what I need to feel. And I go to practice, and that was just more the dress rehearsal.
And the drilling was a daily.
Every day.
Thing. Yeah.
Every day. I've taken 1,000 turns, but I met, like, you look at the ratio between how many throws I took and how many drills I did. I would do, it was more a 10-to-1. Like, mm-hmm. I would do way more drilling. Like, 90% of my practice is actually drilling, and 10% of it is the 20 throws I take in practice.
Because I could see someone like Christian's frustration there, where it's like, well, you're not very big.
Yes.
And you're not very strong in the grand scheme. And you don't train a lot. that would be. So
killed him. Yeah. And it was always a strain between me and Christian. Because Christian's like, I don't get how somebody. Because he sees, like, you know, Adam. He's kind of like, Adam loves being in the weight room. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Adam's working hard all the time. And I'm that guy. I go to my practice. And it's kind of telling on myself. My usual training schedule would be I get up at 9, we go throw it at 10 to 11. So I have breakfast at 9. We train at 11. From 11 till 3 o'clock, we do all the training. And then at 3 o'clock, I go home, and I'm making 6 peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, eating like garbage. And then I wake up the next day. That would be like on a Tuesday. I take Wednesday as a rest day. Get my massage, you know, being pampered, come back on Tuesday, do the same thing again. So it's like, if you look at what I do training wise, it wasn't that either. I was just naturally the most, that's what I got to think. Naturally, I must have been the most talented shot putter in the world. I just have the greatest mind. I can't really distinguish it.
You know, I remember watching you and seeing the lifts and stuff and kind of thinking to myself, even at, you know, 21, 22, like, man, there's something here that can't be measured with a tape measure or, you know, a stopwatch or, mm-hmm. or pounds on the bar. And this timing and rhythm and mm-hmm. technique is certainly not quantifiable in that same way. So before we talk a little bit about the development of your technique, I'm going to bring up the idea of special strength exercises. So we mentioned throwing heavy shots and throwing light shots. Mm-hmm. Did you do a lot of other, you know, what like Bondarchuk folks would call special strength, special developmental exercise?
I mean, we jumped, but I didn't do like the rhythmic, you know, the overhead pushes.
Knee presses.
I didn't do a lot of knee presses. I would say the training that we did was just specific to what we're doing. So we didn't do anything gimmicky. So usually like the beginning of the year, after my diet, do I come back like in October and Don's like, we're going to run for a month. So that's what we would do. We would run for a month to get me into shape. And then we'd start lifting.
We're talking diet. How much would your body weight be fluctuating here?
20 pounds. So I have a general range, and it's more on how I'm moving. Mm. So we'll come in. So my first year, I was probably 2003, I was probably 280, 290. So I'd go up to like 300 during the off season. Then come back down to that 280, and we do that. And then our goal is to only be 10% stronger, maybe sometimes less, than we were the previous year. That was where the journaling came in. Mm-hmm. This is what I lifted at this time last year. This is where I got to be. We'll be a little bit stronger each year. So it wasn't I wanted to make big mass. That's why it took me forever. Like, I started out of college at, 470 in the bench? But it took me that, 5 years to put 500 pounds on there, because the emphasis is just to be a little bit stronger. Because in either Don saw this or I saw it, either way, if I got too strong too fast, it started messing with my technique.
Well, it took too much of your energy. It
took too much of my energy. Yeah. Like, I wouldn't have the timing. I couldn't hit the ball. There are certain balls, like I would start the year at a 14.5-pound ball. And if I go there and I'm moving too slow, if the ball feels heavy. Sometimes if I come in too light, the ball's too light. So I don't get to the training that I want out of the implements.
I remember talking to Don, this must be close to 15 years ago. And he talked about finding your, and this might even be secondhand from Nate Rolfe. But Don talking about finding, 5 or 10 indicators to your success.
Yeah.
Lifts, jumps, whatever. And if you want to add 1% to your throw, which when you're throwing 22 meters consistently, like 1% is a very substantial distance.
Yes.
But if you could add 1% to your bench press, 1% to your squat, 1% to your broad jump, 1% to your overhead backward, whatever it is, these indicators, it becomes a much more measurable, attainable thing. Did you had those sort of markers?
We had some measurables. It's like stand throw. Don was really big on the vertical leap. I'm just like, whatever. So, we do a lot of vertical leap testing. It drove me crazy.
You guys would do stuff with the vertical as well, right? Where, like wearing a weight vest.
Percentage of body weight and how much of reduction of height it would have. I hated doing that. I didn't know why he was doing it. I didn't see the point, But, you see people like Adam, and that's where we did a lot more running. When Adam came in, as much as I love that guy, he brought in the cardio aspect and the jumping and plyometric stuff. So I was trying to move away from it, and Adam's like, no, you got to do more of it. And I'm like, all right, fine. Well, if you're going to be around, I might as well do some of the stuff you're doing. So we do like running and bounding up stairs and standing broad jump, and then Don would implement the weighted vest on me and how high can you jump? And to me, I feel like, okay, maybe, and I know it was just for testing, but the better, the more, the less I would lose off the vertical with the amount of percentage of body weight, I think it just showed an indication like, okay, you're going to throw really well because you can jump nearly the same height with 20% more body weight on your body or something.
Pretty much. Can you move as fast as you can with your body weight? But yes. If we add 16 pounds a little
16
bit.
16 pounds on it,
yeah.
And it doesn't have as much effect,
yeah.
Then, okay, you're going to be doing really well.
You guys implemented some gymnastics in your training.
We did.
Too, right? I remember seeing back UCLA overnight camp.
Yeah.
Going into my senior year of high school, I think Art showed us some videos of you and Adam on the bar and on parallel bars. And did you feel like that was a big contributor to the rhythm and elasticity and everything?
That was actually something I really enjoyed. That was the only training, even though we had to do it before the gymnastics team came in at like 5 o'clock in the morning. I really enjoyed that. That was a lot of fun because we would do ring stuff, we'd do bar stuff, we'd dig medicine balls and get on the horse and throw it side to side, forward, and all that kind of stuff. I thought that was a whole lot of fun. Maybe it did. I did it for probably about 5 years. So I started in my junior year, we'd get up and do it. Adam came in right when I was done my senior, and then as I was starting to progress, so right when I was made my first Olympic team, I think the gymnastics team kicked us out because you don't want a bunch of big fatties on your stuff. So we stopped doing that, but I continue to progress.
So there are weight ratings for parallel bars and stuff?
There probably is.
Yeah.
No, so I remember my senior year, I decided I want to do a back tuck. And so the gymnastics coach was like, yeah, I think you could do it. And I promptly broke his leg. I broke his foot because he tried to spot me. I'm athletic, so I got around. He didn't expect me to just turn around, and he put his foot right where I landed, and I just broke it right in half. So that was that taught him a valuable lesson. Don't try to have like a 290-pound man. Don't try to flip him in the air.
So you had a bit of a, I don't know if unorthodox is the right word, but a unique technique.
Yeah.
With the way you turn on your heel coming out of the back of the ring.
Yeah.
And I thought it was interesting, you know, you have this unique technique, Adam, very unique technique, Christian, unorthodox, you know, a lot of people would point to like a Randy Barnes and be like, oh, that's, you know, that's the textbook rotational technique. But then America for a decade has three guys dominating at the world level with three unorthodox techniques.
Yes.
Was it just natural for you to turn on your heel like that, or was it like, all right, let's give this a shot? And
no, that was just a lack of understanding from my high school coach. That's his fingerprint on my technique. When I first started learning to throw, it was more on sweeping a leg and getting my right foot down and then getting my left foot down. How I got there was my own interpretation. So he just kept emphasizing that, and it never occurred to him that you're supposed to turn on the top, on the balls of your feet, and not on the side. So I'd done, you know, as I say, in high school, I threw every other day. So I'd taken thousands of throws in that year before I went to college, and that's what I brought to Georgia. And Don sees it, and he's like, well, we need to work on it. And that heel turn, I spent 10 years trying to get rid of it. And obviously it didn't work.
Uh-huh.
So then, like, after year 10, Don's like, you know what? We're not going to change it. We're just, as long as you get to this position.
It only took 10 years to give up on changing
it. It only took 10 years where it's just like, I give up. There's nothing we can do. Because when I would do it, you know, you get a little bit more savvy in the throw. I'm like, I'm doing it. Like, I'm not generating enough force forward. I feel like I'm not being linear enough on the ball, so it's not going as far. And throwing is all about how far can you throw. And it feeds into my mind like, I'm wasting throws doing something that I feel like is not making me better. Let's just try to work within the confines of that technique and make it go somewhere and not necessarily worry about where my foot is. So that was just something that happened for my high school coach that just let me do whatever I wanted, and I made the ball go really far, and we just went with it.
Yeah, that's kind of stuff is interesting to me, that these little idiosyncrasies of technique, whether it's throwing or weightlifting, powerlifting, whatever sport it is, you see people who excel with less than, you know, traditionally ideal techniques, but it's like the best technique is that which produces the best result.
Yes.
And that heel turn was certainly that for you.
Well, I feel like the heel turn, what it did for me, since I am not very tall, a lot of the taller throwers don't think about pushing as hard as I do. Mm-hmm. I'm all linear drive. So that when I throw, it's why everything's so flat. If I had a John Godina out the back, I'm on top of the foot, and I'm more jumpy, going up, down, yeah, and then back up again, then I wouldn't do that. But I think I learned, or we saw when I was throwing, I got to create an awesome amount of linear force going out in the throwing area if I ever want to make it go somewhere. And that, yeah, and that's what made it happen.
So now as you've transitioned, was trials 2016 trials?
2016,
last
yeah.
Yeah. So I got to be there for that.
Yeah.
So since 2016, you've now transitioned to have the Hoffa Throws Academy.
Yep.
Here in Georgia. You know, as you have made this transition from athlete to coach, what are some things you're seeing with young throwers that, you know, if you had to say like kind of the Rhys Hoffa system or the Hoffa Throws Academy system,
mm-hmm,
what principles is that really built on?
It's built on just being consistent and finding a technique that you can do over and over again. I like a base technique that you're going to come out there, you're going to do over and over. You can do it over and over again. Doesn't matter how fast, slow, whatever, rain, shine, you can do the same technique. And then we build upon that technique to refine, to figure, okay, what's the next step? So I teach you basically a very watered down technique. Get over the left, sweep your right leg, land on a toe in the middle of the ring, get your left foot down, and then move through the throw. That just rudimentary, that's our base. And then from there, we're like working on, okay, where's your hand? How are you getting on that right foot? How are you sweeping out the back of the ring? How are you finishing the ball? So if you can get all that, in the way I see things, you're going to be really good. And then we're just manipulating where you are. Like I believe that there's no one perfect technique. So this is just a base that you could take what you've learned from me and put it in an Adam Nelson technique or put it in a John Cadena technique. Because not everyone's the same size. Mm-hmm. Even a Walsh technique. Like, I want these kids to be well-versed in every single technique there is and figure out what do they do well. So if you can kind of look at them like, if you're 6'6", okay, and you're not very good at bending your knees, maybe Christian Cantwell's technique is the one we need to go with. And we'll just work a big bench. If you're incapable of doing the big bench, let's look at something else. We look at what you do well, and then we kind of tailor it to what you do.
At a different sport, but Bill Walsh had a great quote about that. And he said, don't tell me what they can't do, tell me what they can do.
Yes.
And I definitely appreciate that idea of tailoring the technique to the athlete rather than trying to jam, square pegs in the round holes.
I think a lot of really good throwers get thrown to the wayside because they can't do a particular technique.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you go to Art Venegas and like Art's got a particular technique. You look at Art and it's like, yeah, that's a Venegas technique right there.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be that kind of person. If anything, I'm Judd Logan, who's like, you just take that kid, I'm going to teach you something basic, and then I'm going to, oh, hey, why don't you, like, I remember going up to Ohio, and Judd's like, hey, I have three athletes here, just coach them for a little bit, because they need to learn something different. And I'm like, okay, and I give them my philosophy, and I'm like, are you guys okay with this? Like, yeah, this is great. We get something outside of what we hear every single day. Maybe this is going to be what you tell me is going to make me feel a little bit further. And it's like, they went for me for one day. And then the second day, was it Joe Kovacs worked with the same people I worked with the previous day. They want to be a sponge. And that's the way I learned the rotation. I started with Randy Barnes and then, CJ Hunter's technique, even Adam did Adam's technique for months on end. I've just learned so many different techniques and how to move. Then I kind of refined it into the Hoffa technique, which everyone else, of a heel turn or whatever else I do. I consider my technique to be just really, it's the most basic of techniques.
Mm-hmm.
But I do that base of a techniques better than anyone else in the world.
Yeah, and there's so many, it's like the principles of good technique is not the way it looks necessarily. It's creating that linear force,
mm-hmm.
where the right foot gets down, the right foot stays moving, getting the left down fast, creating that solid block, converting that energy vertically.
Yeah,
there's so many different ways that can end up looking. Yeah. And the weightlifter, the Soviet weightlifter Vasily Alexeyev, said this about that everyone wanted to do my program. He said, but you can't do my program because then it would be your program.
Yes.
And that, as much as when I was in high school and stuff, I loved going in the ring and doing like impressions of the other throwers. Like,
yeah,
all right, how far can I throw with Reese's technique? How far can I do Adam's technique or John's technique? But same way, I had to do my technique. Even if it ended up looking just like your technique,
yes,
it was mine. Yeah.
No, that, I think that's absolutely true. Like, I am not as flexible as Adam, but his finish is something that I could possibly do. I've looked at John's technique, and it's like, well, my knees don't move the way I think he's double jointed or something. Like, his right toe and heel doesn't move in the direction of the throw, but his knee does. Mm-hmm. That's how he gets his hip around. I can't do that, but maybe his entry. I did John's entry in 2002, where he's like, it was really, really low. I saw him and Andy Bloom.
Dragging that left.
That was my technique. I did that.
I gave that one a shot for a while.
I gave that a shot, and I threw 67 feet doing that. And then Don's like, you know what, Reese? That just doesn't make sense. And Don would just kind of explain, like, maybe you need to be here. I would be on my toes. Like, when I first started, I'm on my tippy toes. Just because anytime I was on my heels, I would just fall backwards and I was just out of control. So Don's like, why don't you just stay on your heels like this person or something? And we just became a student of the sport and try to do their kind of stuff. Like, yeah.
I think that's a great testament to your coordination and athleticism, too, to be able to, like, see a video or a frame-by-frame shot, depending on what year we're talking here,
yeah,
of someone's technique and mimic that and recreate it pretty effectively.
That is, yeah. And I was a student of the sport. That's my thing. Now, when I first started, all the videos that I ever saw were like smuggled away from some random person. And I remember getting like a John Godina video. It was like on TV in California, and getting out there and like analyzing every single throw. We got a Randy Barnes video where a sequence where he broke the world record where he's throwing 75-10 for like two straight meets. Can I not tell him to stop?
Yeah.
Sorry.
No worries.
But anyway. But I remember just getting videos of those kind of, I remember getting a Adam Nelson high school throwing video, and someone took it frame by frame. It was like his entire throw, but it took 20 minutes. So it was like frame by frame by frame by frame by frame, and analyzing it for days. Brian Ofield, just watching the big O. Someone got us a video from the big O, and I just watching it for days, just like, how does he do that? How does Randy do that? And I would do his technique in my driveway. Just like, okay, this is how he did this, and it looks like he's pushing here. And I didn't know what I was looking for. I was just looking at the overall throw. But then trying like go to, hey, I saw that, you know, CJ Hunter does this slow to fast. Is that something we should do? And just becoming a student of the sport.
It had to be then when YouTube came and Rob Soufflon, the 70-footer account, and he had those slow motions from like 88 Olympics and stuff. That's throwing porn right there. That was as good as it gets.
I remember when our high school got a VCR that you could record in slow-mo. That revolutionized all my analysis. Like I took, you know, Randy's world record throw, slow-mo'd it and recorded it. And it was just like, it was revolutionary. I mean, when you first start, you just get everything, you watch everything full speed. I remember when you just actually slow it down, or getting a video that was slowed down.
Kids these days,
they
don't know how easy they've got it.
It was awesome.
So with coaching, it's mostly high school, junior high athletes that you're working with now. From a lifting standpoint and outside the ring training, have your ideas of like strong enough kind of carried over to that?
Well, the kids that I'm working with, they're not strong enough. There's a certain level. Let's put it like that. You need to have a certain level of strength, I think, to move the ball somewhere. And I need to get you to that strength, and then we can actually start tapering away from being the emphasis on weight lifting. So my general rule of thumb, I want you to be around 300 plus, 315 is like, if you can get to 315 and bench it one time or do it for a double or triple, you're strong enough to throw a 12-pound ball pretty far. You know, the squat range is like 450. You know, I don't think that's unreasonable for a high school kid to be able to squat that much. So for the female athletes, 135, we're talking about an 8-pound ball. But it becomes how fast are you moving the bar stuff. And it's no longer just overall power. It's like, can you move 130? Are you going 5 seconds to the top off your chest? Okay, well, that's not benefiting you. So you may be able to do it. Then everything goes to speed training. Like, okay, now you got to really jerk in, move everything really fast because we're trying to work more power of the movement. For my younger kids, so I have kids that are 12 years old that I train. I'm just teaching them how to just move. I took a girl who could literally only jump 12 inches off the ground. And it's just like, okay, and could barely know how to sprint. So you're like teaching them how to run. You're teaching them how to jump. You're like teaching them, okay, this is what a bench press is. And this is how you're supposed to bench in general. So it's all about just kind of working towards where their age group is, what they're trying to do. I've never coached a 12-year-old before. So a lot of what we do is just like, I'm going back to what I know and just watering it way down and trying to be competitive against other kids that are 12. Like, I just want them to win and just watching them blossom. Anytime they can get a 12, 13-year-old kid going to their age group and they do well, I've won. So that's what I try to do.
And do you look at it much differently, you know, doing the things to be the best thrower at age 13 versus doing the things when you're 13 to be the best thrower when you're 23?
I I try to temper it. I'm very competitive. That is my biggest vice. I'm very competitive. I want my kids to win everything. And I push them sometimes too hard. So they'll go out there, and the girl I'm talking about, she started at 50 feet. She throws 98 now, but when she was throwing 50 feet...
The discus we're talking about.
We're talking about the discus. Yeah. Every time she would throw, is like, I have to remind myself that if she throws 5 or 6 inches more, that's actually really good. But in my mind, I'm watching like, well, you're only throwing 50 feet. I could stand throw that now with a 16-pound ball. That's what's going through my mind. And I'm just like...
You really showed that 12-year-old girl.
I know, but I try. That's my biggest thing when I work with kids is if they have, because I never saw myself as an exceptional high school thrower. I threw 64 feet and 180, and I didn't think like it's good, but it's not great. So if they don't reach that standard, I'm like, you got to work harder. That's not good enough. Because, you know, I know when you're going, like, I see the college network, when I'm working with high school kids, I know what you got to throw to get to college. Mm. I have a lot of college friends. I know you got to be really, really good. So I'm always pushing them to go harder. And if you're, and I try to make it fun, but if you're not here to try to go to the absolute best level, that's where we're going to have some issues. And, sometimes I push kids too far, and they're just like, you're negative all the time. But I feel like I'm being negative in a nice way. I just want kids to be really good, and I want them to invest everything they have into it. But I also, on that same foot, I realize that no kid's that crazy. I'm crazy. I am literally crazy, because I will do the same thing over again until I master it, and that to me is fun.
Yeah, I found that when I was coaching high school football, coaching high school track, that it was difficult for me to ask of another person what I know I had done myself before. Because when I kind of took a step back and was like about to verbalize it to them and like, this is what you need to do, the same things that I used to do, like it sounded sort of crazy to me. Like, this can't be an expectation of someone else. But at the same time, that's what you got to do if you want to be very successful.
I write programs. I do online coaching. And I write programs for kids. And I'll say, okay, I want you to take 25 just drills with a stick. 25 half turns. No, 25 stand throws, non-reverse, 25 with reverse. Half turns. Half turn, non-reverse, reverse. South African, non-reverse, reverse. Full throw, 360. And I look at it, and it's like, this is almost 400 turns that they're doing, and they're not even picking up an implement.
My feet are cramping.
And I'm like, to me, it's like, yeah, I've done that before. Like, when I had a job, I worked at a lighting company that does, when I'm sweeping or doing whatever, I would do 25 turns up and down the warehouse. And to me, it's like, that's nothing. Just, 25, okay, I'm going to go do this, come back, I'm going to do half turns, going back. And to me, it's like, it's easy. You just do that in your parking. You know, I would do it at my house.
Yeah,
I'd just be outside for around. Hours just to turning. And
I remember like being you know, standing in the kitchen having a conversation with my mom and just kind of being back on that right side, just working my hip.
But if you do that to the level of mastery, you don't have to think about it. That's my whole point. Like, if you do the little things over time, like it literally just standing there and just working the right hip turning, you just do that and it's just a reflex and not something that you have to constantly think about. When you actually do it in the throw, it's going to make things so much easier.
Yeah.
Because you've done it a million times.
Yeah. And whether it's the mental rep of it, it's the physical rep of it, you know, you're adding thousands of repetitions. I remember being on an official visit at Cal with Nate Rolfe, who, you know, ended up here at University of Georgia eventually. Yeah. And we were leaving dinner, and, you know, there's 10 of us on this visit. And we're walking back out to the van or whatever, and just out of nowhere, he's just like full speed South African with the follow through and everything. And then just keeps walking and like having the conversation. And I was looking at him like, I know I do this some as well, but like, this seems so oddly timed. But it was like mid sentence, South African, and just keep talking again.
Oh, yeah. I like Nate.
Yeah.
Nate was awesome. I love Nate at Georgia. Oh, my gosh. I wish he didn't leave.
Yeah. So where can they find you, follow you, learn more about what you do?
They can find me on Hoff of Throws. They can find me at CorbinTrainingAndWellness.com. They can find me at Reese at Hoffa Massage. I also do massage therapy, where I'm also doing some stuff with the Forge, which is a body tempering device. You can find me, I think, Reese Hoffa at Forge HDF. I feel like you type Reese anywhere, you're going to be able to find me.
Reese Hoffa into the Google machine.
Google machine, you can find me. My Twitter's at Hoffa Throws, my Instagram's at Hoffa Throws. Reese Hoffa at Corbin Training Wellness is an email. I mean, you could, if you want to find me, I think even my phone number is on Google. That's crazy. I get phone calls from people all the time. Where, how did you get this number? It's like, yeah, I Googled you. I didn't know that was on there. Okay, fine. So,
all right, you hear that? You can Google Reese's phone number, text him, trade some texts with a Olympic bronze medalist. So this was the Jug Life Podcast. Subscribe, 5 stars on iTunes, all that good stuff. Subscribe to the YouTube. Visit JTSstrength.com for online coaching, powerlifting, weightlifting, super total, strongman, power building, our AI coaching, helping thousands of athletes with totally customized programming right now. So go on and check that stuff out. Chad Wesley Smith, at Chad Wesley Smith, and at Juggernaut Training on Facebook and Instagram. Reese, thanks for taking the time, buddy.
Yep.
And everyone, thanks for listening.
Yep.